Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Old Brother, a podcast about legendary musical institution The Fall. Each week we invite along a guest to chat about their experiences and memories of the group. As you probably know by now, we consist of me, Paul Hanley, and my brother Steve, who was a member of the band for 20 years. You can find us at all the usual suspects. We're hosted at play.acast.com/s/oldbrother. All episodes are also available on YouTube. Search for Old Brother Podcast and subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. This week we're joined by legendary producer and all-round good guy John Leckie, who can count three of the most successful Fall albums among the myriad of legendary records he's produced. Hope you enjoy it.
Old Brother, the podcast about the Fall, a podcast about the Fall, featuring me, Paul Hanley, and my brother, the bass player for a long time, Mr. Stephen Hanley. All right, Steve, are you well?
Yes, I'm fine, thanks. You?
Good, good, good. Yeah, great. We've got a VIP this week, very important producer.
Yes.
I think I'm right in saying that working with The Fall is the highlight of his career, I think. I don't think anybody's going to argue with.
Not looking at all the other stuff he's done, I don't think so.
No, to be fair, I think the highlight of his career was producing the intro to the Old Brother podcast.
Absolutely, I think that's probably it.
Yeah, so without further ado, Mr. John Leckie. Good afternoon, John. How are you?
Good afternoon. Happy to be here. Yeah, for have a good chat.
Thanks for doing it.
We've only really spoken probably in the studio, but even then we didn't really speak much because we just got on with it.
We did. I mean,
it was frowned on then.
It's a never-ending source of frustration for me that I didn't sit down for 12 hours and grill you about your career before we met. But now's my chance. So, you started as a tape hob at Abbey Road, is that right? Is that how you started off in music?
That's right, yeah.
How did you get that? How does one become a tape hop at Abbey Road in 1970?
It's interesting, is that how you started in music? Because you probably know I'm not really a musician. I mean, I've never played in a band. I can bash out some chords on the guitar or the piano, but that's about it. I was never a musician. And funny enough, when I was growing up, none of my mates were musicians. You know, I didn't know anyone. I made a couple of guys at school, but I didn't know them that way. I didn't hang out with musicians. But I did go to lots of gigs. Three times a week.
So you had no aspirations to be in a band then?
No, I always wanted to be down the front in the audience or up the back doing the sound check, getting the sound, because I used to go to gigs and notice how much, how the sound was always be different and everything. And you look in, and then I saw a recording studio and it looked like a spaceship. You know, it was all flashing lights and dark and, you know, mysterious and lots of levers to pull and buttons to push. And it was just like a spaceship. So I thought, oh, I want to work in a spaceship.
So how did you come to getting into a studio in the first place? So,
in the studio. First place, I wrote a letter. I went to college. I did a film and TV thing at college. I got A-levels at school, went to grammar school, got A-levels, got geography and physics and didn't get maths. I just couldn't even get O-level maths. It just went in one ear and out the other. But somehow I liked the physics and I liked the geography and that stuff. So it was no good going to university. So I don't know. I just went to a film and TV course at a college in Bromley, which is right on the other side of London. It used to take me about 2 hours every day to get there and get back on the train. But I did that. And I guess through that and all the end of the college course, all that was on offer was a BBC job. You know, I went for the interview and instantly got the job at the BBC. But again, it was more exams and all that kind of thing. And then I got a job in a little film company down in Soho in the West End. And then I thought, oh, fuck, what can I do? I must be able to do something. I know, I'll write to all the recording studios. One thing I've missed out, actually, because at college, nothing to do with film and television, I did a thesis, my end of term thesis that everyone had to write, and you could choose the subject. So I chose electronic music. And so I wrote, I don't know how many words, I've still got it in a folder, and it's all handwritten with, you know, fountain pen and ink. Is not even typed out, really, and all the drawings and stuff. But at the time, this is 1967, and so I used to go around record shops and take notes on the back of Stockhausen records and anything the electronic music, weird Italian composers and things that did electronics, and the French and the Germans. had laboratories, they were called, to like the radiophonic workshop. But it was more for composers. See, the radiophonic workshop was a service to BBC Radio and provided the film music, you know, the music and stuff.
Yeah.
And they didn't actually do what you could say compositions that would be performed by an orchestra or performed in a concert hall kind of thing.
Yeah.
But the French and Germans and the Italians and the Greeks and everyone else in Europe was well into a concert being turning on a tape machine with an orchestra or people playing along to a tape machine, as bizarre as what the music was, you know, right. Stockhausen and Schoenberg and Pierre. And also the French had musique concrète, concrete music, where you cut up, you cut up tape and stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I wrote this thesis on electronic music, and I also, because I was at the TV college, we had a TV studio tied with a drama studio. So we would do a drama production with the drama school, and it was actually Chekhov plays, which was what the drama students were studying, and we did 28 Chekhov plays. Wow. A different one every 2 weeks. And set four cameras up, professional, proper cameras, and then took it in turns under supervision kind of thing to do a different job. So 1 week you'll be a cameraman and then you'll be doing the sound. Then you might be the director, you might be the vision mixer, you know, director. You have to talk to the actors kind of thing. So it's a bit scary for a 17-year-old, you know.
Hell of an opportunity, though, all
the
same.
It was, yeah, it was great. I had a really good time, but there was a lot of chaos and a lot of happening, you know, 1967, 68, you know, LSD at weekends and things, and then struggling over to Bromley to go to for 9 o'clock, you know, getting up at 7 and going to the go. And then you had to do tech college. So you also had to do what's called City and Guilds with electronics. And it's a telephone engineer. So you sat in a classroom with a load of telephone engineers and learnt the electronics and the line transmission. So I got all that and stuff. And I guess that's how I got a job at Abbey Road. But I suddenly dawned on me when I was working in this film called, I know, I'll write some letters to the to all the studios. And at that time, all the studios, there was only about five studios, which was EMI, Decca, Olympic, I think it's called IPC in Regent Street Way. I think that was it, really. I just wrote some letters, and Abbey Road EMI was the only one that replied, and they said, come for the interview, and I showed him my thesis, and they showed me round, and a month later phoned up and said, can you start on Monday, kind of thing. So
blimey.
That's how I got
very the job. Good.
What was that?
Yeah, so that'll be just after Jeff Emmerich left for Apple then, wouldn't it?
Well, there was a lot of vacancies. That's right. Yeah. Jeff Emmerich left for Apple and Air Studios as well. No, I'm not quite certain. There was Jeff Emmerich with Apple and Air Studios was happening.
Yeah, of course, that was George Martin.
That's right, and Dave Harris came from Abbey Road. All those big studios, all that they were people from Abbey Road, you know.
Yeah.
So there was vacancies. And it's funny because I tell you another story is Neil Richmond was the guy, was the tape op who's everyone says, oh, I got his job because he was sacked. And you know what he was sacked for? Late night session, he took his shoes off. So he just had his socks on to do the session because it was like gone midnight kind of thing. And on this late session, so he just stopped running the tape and had his feet up on the chair, but didn't have his shoes on. And all of a sudden the manager of the studio, whose name was Alan Stagg, who was a real military guy and, you know, real law and order and very strict. I never met him. He came in, saw this guy not wearing his shoes and instantly fired him.
Right.
And said, like you. Leave the session, leave the building right now and go home, kind of thing.
In the room where they recorded Sergeant Pepper, presumably,
that's
he got
correct.
Sacked for not having shoes on.
Well, have been doing Sergeant Pepper at the time. But
to be fair, Mark has sacked a few drummers, though, didn't he, for taking your shoes off?
you'd sack Carl for taking his shoes off,
While eating a sandwich,
yeah. So you worked. Is that true that you worked with all the Beatles individually at Abbey Road? Is that true?
Yeah, individually. So I started 1970 February, and they were mixing Let It Be, but all of Abbey Road had been recorded in 1969, the year before the album.
Yeah,
and they'd gone, like John had just done in December, John had done Instant Karma. Paul was up in Scotland doing his stuff on his own. Ringo was making a record called Sentimental Journey, which is...
Yeah, a couple of versions, aren't they?
Yeah. Pub songs, a picture of a pub on the front. Well, I tape up some of that. I even tape up some of that, you know.
Did you?
Yeah.
Wow. Bloody hell.
Well, you just sit at the back, really, and take notes kind of thing. I think they were overdubbing. I don't know. I can't remember much about it, really. And then also when Paul came, and then I also did a session that I had a really vague memory of, and this guy phoned me up who was writing a book about Paul McCartney. I had all the dates and, you know, the recording sheets and the tape boxes, so that it's all got my initials on kind of thing and the actual dates. And, oh, you must have worked with Paul McCartney on March the 15th on this session because you've written the tape box out, you know, and you were there.
Wow.
And I don't remember much about it, actually. I remember John Curlander, not much, been just Paul and Linda and wondering where the band was and listening back endlessly to the four tracks. I think he'd just come down from Scotland with what he'd recorded. Maybe I'm amazed. Right. On that first solo album, Maybe I'm Amazed and stuff.
And we're just playing back.
But the funny thing was, I always remember standing up in Studio 2 and that you got the control room is upstairs, and so you look down on the big studio, if you remember.
Yeah.
And you see it. And Paul and Linda were there, and so the doors were closed and everything was done. Paul and Linda were down there, and Paul was making tea. He had a kettle and he was making tea, and he was waving at me, and I was like, oh, what's he saying? And, you know, I'd only been there like a week, and I couldn't work the speakers or anything, and there was no one there. So I opened the door and said, what, you know, did you want something? He said, do you want a cup of tea? I'm like, yeah, of course, yeah, thanks, yeah, great, and sort of went back in. And then he called, as I came down the stairs to get it, he said, it's Orange Pico. And I'm like, oh, Orange Pico. He says, why, is that all right? And I'm going, yeah, I'll have it. So I took this Orange Pico tea, and it looked like tea, of course, and I thought it was going to be like orange juice. And so I drank it. I thought I was just really expecting it to taste like orange juice, and it didn't at all. It just tasted like tea. It's funny, like, is he having me on, you know?
You only had English breakfast then, didn't you?
Yeah.
So I have to make sure that this whole discussion isn't just you saying something and me saying wow after it, because, you know, there's a lot of that. Because I've got a list here of people you worked with before the fall.
Oh, yeah.
And they're all on there, aren't they? Sid Barrett. You worked with Sid Barrett?
Yeah, I tape up some sessions in the 70s, in the very early 1971, the second Barrett album.
Right. That must have been a bit bizarre. He was on his way by then, wasn't he?
I suppose so, yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose so. I didn't speak to him much. He didn't speak to me much, but he did.
I don't think he spoke to
anyone much. No. And it was difficult. My only memory is trying to get a song that was complete, you know, because when you write tape boxes, if the song's complete, then you usually write complete. And if it's a full start, you put FS, full start, which means they don't come in at the top.
Right.
And a BD is not a bass drum, it's a breakdown, which means they get to the second verse, and as they go into the second chorus, they fuck up and stop. Well, that's a breakdown, you see, that's not a full start.
Yeah, because they kept everything at Abbey Road, is that right? They kept everything you recorded? Or was that, I mean, I've read that about the Beatles, so that was just them, or was that for everybody, they just kept everything?
I think not necessarily, no. It depends on the producer and whether you would wipe tape. So if you're doing, even maybe with the Beatles, I'm not quite certain. I don't think when you see, like when they've done, you know, 64 takes of something, something, it doesn't mean 64 takes because they might have been including all the full starts and breakdowns. You always give it a number because then it's reference, you see.
Right, okay.
Because you might do a great intro, you know, drum fill and the band kicks in and go, wow, that's great. And then you never get it as good as that for whatever reason.
Yes, yes.
So even a full start you can use and edit on, you know, particularly a breakdown, you know.
I'm sure it's a little bit easier to do that kind of thing these days.
Not kidding.
Yeah.
Would that have been your job then, with a bit of chalk and the razor blade, doing that kind of stuff?
Yeah, eventually, yeah, pretty quickly, yeah. That's what you would do.
I don't know how you had the bottle to do that. It must be a bit nerve-wracking.
No, it's not really. You just don't think about it.
No, so the big one I want to mention, which I know Steve is keen to talk about, Mott the Hoople.
Mott the Hoople, yes.
Oh, yeah. Mott the Hoople, that's right. I actually recorded all the way from Memphis. On the piano.
Wow. Oh, same wow again.
I remember him coming in, look, not early, like 11 or just before lunch kind of stuff, and bashing away at the piano, and someone got him a sandwich or something, and he was just like trying to work out the piano run. This is Ian Hunter.
Yeah.
And had the song, and by 4 o'clock we'd taken it and done it. You know, we'd been set up for doing other stuff as well. But actually, we moved into 3, which is a smaller studio. So we started off in 2, and it was all a bit spacious. And as soon as we went into 3, he loved the piano. And, you know, it was just a smaller room, you know.
Right.
And I can't remember what else we did. Drive-In Sister, what else is on that record? Didn't do Honolulu Boogie. I think I did nearly everything apart from Honolulu Boogie.
Wow.
And never.
I'm wowing again.
Yeah. And Him for the Dudes is on it, isn't it? And is.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a good run. I had a good run actually because I did Mott the Hoople. I did Wizard as well. I did a whole album like a week with Roy Wood and Wizard and his jazz thing. And at the end of the record, and a lot of it that wasn't singing, it was kind of instrumental kind of stuff. And jazz arrangements. And at the end, we played it on the speakers and re-recorded it playing on the speakers as if it was in a nightclub. So we got a load of glasses and knives and forks and plates and rattled them around while the music was playing and used that as the album, you know. And you know what? It never came out. I've never
not traced a big market out. For a Wizard jazz album, I wouldn't have thought.
Well, they were great, you know, with the horn section, you know, and Roy plays all that, and the cello, you know.
Yeah, well, he sort of started that electric light orchestra thing, didn't he? That was him originally. Yeah.
And he doesn't really.
You didn't get points on I Wish It Could Be Christmas Every Day, did you?
I wish it could be Christmas. See My Baby Jive. Steve Lillywhite did that as an engineer, See My Baby Jive. I think he recorded that and mixed it, but he never produced it, but he was the engineer and all that. And then Ballpark Incident, Alan Parsons.
Oh, that's a great song.
Oh, yeah, it was terrifying, that. Because they did that in 2, right, when Alan Parsons was doing Dark Side of the Moon, you know.
Yeah.
So Alan really knew the room, you know, and what was going on.
Yeah, of course.
And he just churned out all these, you know, Make Me Smile, Come Up and See Me. That group Pilot he did a lot of stuff with, you know, all that 73, 1974.
Yeah, yeah. So this will be the wilderness years before punk came along to save us all and bring some decent music in.
Yeah.
What a load of balls.
It's funny that about the 70s, isn't it? Yeah, punk came along because everything was boring, but the amount of music that came out just a couple of years before.
The amount of gigs people were going to as well. Like you say, John, you were going to two or three a week.
But definitely, yeah.
So were we.
We used to go Tuesdays and Thursdays always, and even a Friday or a Saturday. You know, we never went for all-nighters on a Saturday, but roundhouse on Sunday afternoons at 4.
You could write a song about that.
Did you float up there, did you?
And there were a lot of free Hyde Park concerts on a Saturday afternoon. I mean, nearly every Saturday afternoon, 16 nights.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a particular bugbear of mine. When the Rolling Stones were on the bones of their arse in 1968 and they owed the tax man 18 million quid, they did a free concert in Hyde Park 2 years ago. They're all multimillionaires, £125 a ticket.
Man.
But anyway, I'll move on. So we get to the sort of late 70s. You did 79, you did Public Image, the single?
That's right, yeah, yeah. No credit or anything, but Jim, what's his name? Jim Walker, the drummer.
Jim Walker, Donut.
Yeah, yeah, he was great. Canadian from Vancouver and came over on the off chance, just come over and slept on the floor on people's settees and any gigs going, you know, and rehearsed with the band and answered the ad in Melody Maker kind of thing. And
because that's a great album. That so they did the single on its own, did they? And then did the album.
Yeah, yeah, I was cool. I'd left Abbey Road just before, months before, and was kind of not really working for Virgin, but they were acting as my management to get me gigs because I'd already produced loads of, I'd produced Bebop Deluxe and the adverts, and I produced about...
Magazine. Yeah. So is there any particular reason you left Abbey Road then, John?
Yeah, because the only reason I left is because they wouldn't hire me out. They wouldn't let me work for another record company unless I brought them into Abbey Road, right? Because it was EMI and they trained me, and I could only work for EMI Studios, like doing another band that, like Mott the Hoople, was on CBS and on Sony, and I could do that at Abbey Road. But when it came to doing XTC. At the Manor Studios, this was signed to Virgin, and the Manor Studios, and then the Townhouse. I did the first XTC album at the Manor because they said they couldn't hire me out. I said, well, they don't want to come to Abbey Road. They can't afford it. They want to do an album, but they want to know what rate you would charge for me to go and engineer the record or produce the record. I ended up producing it.
Right. So you'd have just been on EMI wages no matter how much they charged.
Absolutely, yeah. They could charge £1,000 a day and I'd just get me wages kind of thing. That's the way it would have worked, and that's the way it did work for a lot of people, you know.
It worked a lot for George Martin a long time for that, didn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, it got to the stage where they said no, and almost to the... And it was mad because the week I left Abbey Road, I had three albums in the charts in the top 20. I had Bebop Deluxe, XTC and The Adverts, I think, were the three albums. Wow. And The Adverts was a top 20 single. No Time to Be 21, it was called.
Ah, right, okay.
And so anyway, I was trained by them and and was providing independent, not all EMI, bringing in other companies to work at the studio and doing top 20 albums, top 20 singles. And I said, oh, sorry, you know, you have to, you know, come back in a year's time. We can't find a position for you. So, you know, so of course, the obvious thing was to leave and just be freelance trying to get a manager or someone to deal with all that, because you fucking work every day. I mean, there's no time for anything. There's no social life. You never watch a film. You never sit down and watch telly because you're always in the studio or you're sleeping. I mean, it's like that, really. nonstop from one project to the other. When I look at, you know, I haven't got diaries for some of those times, but when I look at like what I did, it was just full on every 7 days a week and going all over the place with all different things. Yeah.
So you were at the beck and call of some of the band, I imagine. If they want to be in there at 3 a.m, you've got to be there, haven't you, I suppose?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So speaking of bands that want to be there at 3 a.m, so you were freelance by sort of late by the 80s then, were you? And just working for people who wanted to hire you?
That's right, yeah. Yeah. From right. when I left Abbey Road, so yeah, all through then and until I met you, I suppose, yeah. And still was. I never really got a manager until 1985, 86. So
till you finish working with the Fall, right? I need a manager now.
It was a bit like that.
Yeah. So how did you come onto the Fall's radar, or how did they come onto yours? Was that Beggar's Banquet got you? Was it
Beggar's Banquet? I think it was Terry Hollingsworth was the A&R guy, and he sent me a cassette, you know, a tape of some demos. I can't remember what it was. It was probably a Peel session,
right? Something. Okay,
and I phoned him up and said, yeah, you know, send me some more stuff. And he sent me the video for, what's it called? Perverted by Language.
Oh, that's right.
He said, send me a cassette and the VHS video. If you can get the
you've got the job.
Yeah, it's a whole video, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
It's great. Eat yourself fitter and all that.
Yeah.
Not the biggest budget of videos, but...
No, it's not exactly two tribes.
I've still got it on VHS, yeah. Anyway, he sent me that, and I said, yeah, I'll do it. When do you want to do it? When do you want to, you know, come in? I can't remember it being an album. Maybe it was...
No, I think we did. Did we do Old Brother first?
We did. Yeah. Didn't we do Old Brother and Creep first?
I think so, yeah.
But was it the same studio? Because we did them two singles, and then we did Wonderful and Frightening World, didn't we? Were they at the same place?
I think it was. It was all at
Focus, was it?
Focus, yeah, which was in South London somewhere. And it was suggested or demanded by Beggar's Banquet by Terry Hollingsworth, because I don't know if they were getting a what deal or I don't know what, you know, oh, you're going to do it there, that studio, is that okay? And I always liked the challenge of working at different studios. You know, since I'd left Abbey Road, I just wanted to work. I always liked the challenge of going into any studio, even with a mixer that you'd never seen before, and making a record. You know, it was much more exciting.
So what, you had no say in that whatsoever then?
If I'd objected, I'm sure, I could have objected, but I have no objection, really. I think I went to see the studio, and it was quite big, and it was wood, and, you know, I think it was upstairs, the control room upstairs, and it was quite a lot of space there, I remember, because we had the two drummers, yeah.
Because we needed it, didn't we, because with the two drummers and everything, yeah. Because we were kind of on a bit of an upward trajectory studio-wise, because we'd done stuff at Cargo, which was in Rochdale, that was like 16-track. And then we went to Pluto in Manchester, which we did. That was the first 24-track we used, I think. And that was where we did Perverted by Language. So that was just... Oh, no, hang on. It was just before you, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Perverted by Language.
Yeah.
And then we went to London, because that was like, so that was like, you know, one of the best studios we'd been in, I think, by then.
Yeah.
We weren't used to decent studios.
happened very, very soon after, it was sold to Stock Aitken Waterman.
That's right.
It became the Stock Aitken Waterman studio. They bought it.
Right.
So as far as, and it was exclusively for them, so you couldn't use it.
Right.
I don't know what it's like now. I can't even remember the address. Yeah.
Okay. Right.
Great sound we got there. I mean, the sound
was really good. Really good drum sound and everything. As people have heard, if they'd heard the intro to this, that's that's not me either. That's Carl, isn't it? I was on keyboards on Old Brother, as I recall. Because I remember you hired in a decent keyboard, because I had that bloody Snoopy thing, that thing that had been with the band since the band formed, since the second gig. And it had been passed down, and it was falling to pieces. And I think you took one look at it and said, "Well, I'm not using that." But I have really good memories of that session. It was really good, although they all kind of blend into each other for me, the two singles and the album.
That's right.
How long would that have taken? How long do you reckon we were in for the Wonderful and Frightening World of? Do you reckon 2 weeks, maybe?
Yeah, 2 weeks. I'd say 2 weeks, if not more. Then where did we mix it? Was it mixed there? I can't remember. I should have researched this.
I don't know, actually, because I don't know that we were there for the mix. I don't think I was. I think it was.
I'm not so sure I was either. I think it was just Mark and Briggs, was it?
I think it were. It could have been, yeah. And we may have. I don't know if we went there or if we went to Blackwing, which was another studio near London Bridge.
I have a memory of coming down for one night to listen to the drums. Mark asked me to come down.
Oh, yeah.
And it was one night, and which was kind of unprecedented. I don't know why he did it. I don't know if he was trying to curry favour or something, but I went down and said, listen to the drums for one night. And it was basically just to say, yeah, that'll do that. I don't think I had much say about how it turned out, but I think that was for The Wonderful and Frightening World of, I think.
Okay.
I don't think it was the same studio, though. I think it was somewhere else. Yeah, so you might be right. Because how did you find that with them working with two drummers? You hadn't done that. Did Wizards have two drummers? I can't remember now. No, they didn't, did they? I'm getting them mixed up with Shawdy Waddy. Yeah,
no, they did. Roy Wood played the drums. He always laid down two drums. And
right.
on the recording, he would play drums with the other. There were two drummers on Wizard, of course.
Ah, right. All right, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think so. We did them both at the same time, didn't we? So you'd need. So that must have been a bit unusual to have two drummers playing at the same time, I presume.
how else are you going to do it other than to a click?
Well, you get Roy Wood to come in and overdub it. That's how you do it.
I think we did. It was pretty much all live, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I think so. I seem to remember I've got to say a sample. I mean, it wouldn't have been a sample then. Carl smashing a bottle on something at the beginning of Old Brother.
I don't know
that was live.
Yeah, it could be edited in, yeah. But no, I'm sure it was all live. I always remember Carl, is it the end of Lay of the Land or 2x4 where Carl plays the bass through the Cray amp? He comes off.
Yeah, yeah. The end of Lay of the Land.
The end of Lay of the Land, yeah.
The end of Lay of the Land when he plays.
Finally, some decent bass.
Yeah.
But when he'd do that, you know, and we did all that live, it was fantastic.
But when we played it live, that song, he'd do that. He'd get by the time he got off the kit, put the bass on. Found the plectrum, switched the amp on, the song was over.
There's a lot of that, though. That's the only thing with two drummers, one of them playing keyboards, one playing bass. There's a lot of pissing about, isn't there? Get up, get back down, walk around there, because we weren't exactly playing Wembley Stadium, so there wasn't a lot of room for an Uber. Pain in the arse.
Well, it looked and sounded great as well.
Yeah? It looked all right when we both sat down. It's just us shuffling about, like, it didn't look so great. But what can you do? So I'm trying to think what was on that. So there was, Lay of the Land, that was the first one, and we did that sort of... you got a credit for vocals on that, John?
We did that. Lay.
That was from Quatermass. I think they'd been on the telly just before. There was a TV series about Quatermass, and there was this cult in it. I see if memory serves. And then we had Dingy in, didn't we? Gavin from the Virgin Prunes.
He was good.
I was gonna say we did quite a lot then, because we did The Wonderful and Frightening World of the Fall and that Call for Escape Route EP all at the same time, didn't we?
Mm-hmm.
I think. Is that right, Steve?
Yeah, that is right, yeah. That was all in that studio.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Well, we worked hard. We'd do 3-4 songs a day, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes.
Well, I know you. I find it hard to see how people spend that much more. You know. I mean, the idea that people spend months and months and months recording songs that they then go on to play live. What do they do? I mean, I'm not being flippant. I don't understand how you can do it. If you go in an album that's got 11 songs on, which you can all play at the same time on stage. How do you spend months doing that? Is it all mixing? It must get a bit tortuous.
If you're just going to go in, if you're going to play it the way that you play it on stage, the time is spent on, what could you say, rearranging parts.
Right, okay. Because you know where I'm going with this.
I can see where you're going.
Certain other Manchester band who managed to spend 5 years doing an album.
That's right. Yeah, there you go.
What were they doing?
Every little detail, you lose confidence in it, and you question every little detail, every nuance, you know, and then you want to try different guitars, you know, play exactly the same part, different guitars, different amps, and all those things. and you go on forever, you know, especially now with a computer, because you know, you're
it's not even on track,
tracks. It's not like 16 track and that's it. You know, there's no more, you can't overdub anything, you know.
No.
Now it's stupid because people record, you know, a guitar with six microphones and you end up with six microphones of one guitar, you know, and then they, oh, can we double track it? And that's 12 microphones. That's 12 tracks on your fucking computer just for two guitars, you know, when, you know, that's how a lot of people do it. So you can choose what mic you want later. For fuck's sake,
right.
Choose the mic now and get on with the music, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there's got to be a payoff with performance, hasn't there, when you start doing that?
Always, every time. It's always about the, but it has nothing to do with the equipment or anything. It's about performance and vibe and attitude and, you know, musical, if you're doing solos and things, dexterity or natural thing. It's always, you always, even if the solo's a bit out of tune, you go with the vibe, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and the same with tracks, you know, this whole thing of playing to click tracks, you know, which everyone seems to do, and click tracks on the grid, you know. And
I hate that. I hate playing to click track, which it seems to be, you're not allowed not to these days, are you? I don't think.
Well, of course you can.
not in the bands I'm in, you're not.
I tell you why. Because as soon as you play to a click track, it sounds modern. It sounds, everything's in its place. It sounds direct. What's that word? Everything's sharpened when you get the photograph and you sharpen.
Right. Okay.
You
know? Yeah.
And so that's
high resolution.
Yeah, high resolution, and that little thing that you slide across that says sharpen on your photography thing. That's what you're doing by playing to the grid, you know. All the detail, all the mystery or the blurriness is taken out. You know, the mystery is in the blurriness, I suppose. And as soon as you sharpen, you know, you look at an over-sharpened photograph and then listen to a dead tight to the grid song being played, you know. There's a similar, you know, the same sort of thing, but it's it never lasts. That I always thought it was when everyone was playing, what is it, quiet verses and loud choruses, you know, exploding like the Pixies, and then really quiet or something. Pixies was just one of them. Nirvana, everyone was doing it in the 90s kind of thing. It's like a big explosion. It's like going on a fairground ride. And you think, wow, this is great. The drums are to the click, the grid, everything's in tune. Yeah. It's all like all the drum fills, you know, everything comes in time. Wow, that's great. And the song's finished. And it's like you've had that funfair ride, you know, you've experienced that. And you don't want to hear it again because you know it's all right.
Yeah.
Whereas when you hear something that's not done to a click and is not, you know.
Well, do you think it takes something away then?
Yeah, it does. It takes away the human element, you could say. Yeah. You know.
So, on a similar note then, so was there any kind of pressure from Beggars Banquet, because they'd invested it, to make the fall brighter and poppier, or...
I don't remember Beggars Banquet. It was more... I don't know. It was a general feeling with... I first met Mark and Brits at John Fogerty's house, Mind of Music, the publisher guy.
Yeah.
In Made a Vow in his place. And he's okay. He's real London, sort of bloke publisher sort of thing. And I saw him about a year or two ago, actually. I hadn't seen him for when Mark died, actually. We were going to go up to the funeral. I don't know if you know what... this whole story there, but I got together with John Fogerty after bloody 30 years, you know.
Yes.
And because of his publishing, he made a lot of money from sampling. You know, he bought the publishing rights on the Fatback Band and not Nile Rodgers, all that disco stuff that was getting on in the late 70s. He just bought the publishing that no one was interested in, and then they started sampling it, and he was getting loads of dosh, you know. But he never seems anyway. I went to it. That's how I met. And also Brits being there, of course, made it all much more, what could I say? Effervescent. You got to remember my experience with the fall was that all it was immediately having Brits there, you know?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
No, I don't remember the press being pressure from Beggars Banquet to, there was never anybody from in the studio from the label.
I don't remember anybody from the record company in the studio. Because you see them films are like, you know, there's films like Bob Dylan and stuff in the studio, and there's like 35. I'm not comparing the fault of Bob Dylan, but that thing where the record company comes down and stands there and listens all day, it must be a pain in the arse. But yeah, so it was kind of internal, the idea that the Fall would get a bit poppier at that point, you reckon? I think so.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know whether the songwriting changed much. Per se, I mean, there was definitely, like you say, a little bit of a polish, bit of fairy dust put on the bastard, wasn't there? I think that was down to you.
Maybe it's down to you as well. Everyone getting themselves together and the instruments, and you know, I don't remember there being big. Discussions about sound or sonics. You know, it wasn't like
we rarely talked about music, did we?
Never. really? You know, we've been in bands, I've said this before, we've been in bands since with people who will spend all day and all night talking about that chord sound. You play there and what that move from then the bridge and this bit. And we never had a conversation like that ever. I mean, I don't think we had the language, to be honest, to do it. So, no, we weren't, A, we weren't interested, and B, we couldn't have talked about it even. So then, of course, then the next big step was you did This Nation's Saving Grace.
That's right. That was the next year, I suppose, or not too long after.
So that, which is kind of held up by a lot of people as, well, obviously it depends who you ask.
Greatest like record of all time.
Well, yeah. Greatest record of all time. Thanks, lads.
That was another one where the studio was chosen by Beggar's Banquet.
Where was that then?
It was called the Music Factory, I think. Music Factory, and it was in Holloway Road, which is north, like Seven Sisters, Finsbury Park.
Okay.
That sort of area south of Hampstead Heath, kind of, but before Camden, between Camden and Hampstead Heath kind of thing. And it was a big modern studio. It had really good equipment and stuff. And it was all kind of sliding glass doors and quite a lot of space to move around. And it was okay. It was quite airy, daylight as well.
Right.
Which no one was really into, really. but they always think that's a big plus for studios.
Well, I always think the best studios are the ones where you can't tell whether it's night or day.
That's right, yeah.
I think. So, you know, you could be 3 a.m, could be 3 p.m, and you're just in the studio, aren't you? You're just kind of in that zone.
Yeah. Well, the worst thing, and that's, what's that studio up in Liverpool? Parr Street as well. And it's got... it's got these roof windows, roof lights. So there's also a motor museum. I think you can cut out the daylight. But they've got in Parr Street, they've got these skylights. And so it's always daylight. And it's like, have you got any curtains? You know, can't you get some curtains on that window and do it? And you'd end up getting a blanket or putting your coat over the window to just kind of quieten the sun down, you know.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah, but we don't want the sun shining on. We don't want daylight shining on the magic. Yeah, let's face it. So what were your experiences of that then, Steve? Because you had been away and came back, didn't you, for...
It's a weird one for me, that This Nation's Saving Grace. Because I'd only just come back into the band after like 6-7 months off.
Right.
So you did. So was it Couldn't Get Ahead was the single without that you weren't on, Steve? Is that right?
Yeah, that's going to ask John. Did you do some work? You did some work with Simon on bass then.
That's right. And you never played on Cruiser's Creek?
I didn't play on Cruiser's Creek, no.
Okay, because that was.
They did a lot of stuff in them months.
Yeah, that's right. We went to that studio. I can't remember what it's called now. It's called The Chapel, I think, and it's in Hampton Bishop near Hereford. And it's actually the converted chapel with a house next door. And again, Beggar's Banquet found it. I think for £200, you got the house with 6 bedrooms and a kitchen and everything. And a chapel next door where you could record, which was great. I mean, I did quite a few records there. I did XTC, Gene Loves Jezebel. I did an album with them there. Yeah, there you go. It was my home for that period.
So they were on Beggar's Banquet as well, weren't they?
That's right. Yeah. And yeah, we did Couldn't Get Ahead and Rolling Danny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Cruiser's Creek.
And Vixen.
Hang on, we Vixen, apparently. Did Britz's single.
And you were working on the Adult Now, I was going to say. Yeah, it was quite a time.
Incense and Peppermints, yeah. You know. Mark was going, okay, we're going to do Britz's song today. I'm going to the pub. And he'll go to the pub. And
suited but, everybody. So the Fall were on that, were they? They were on Incense and Peppermints. That was...
Yeah, it's Carl. One. It's Carl on drums. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And Simon, I presume.
And Simon, and he had Britz's mate, whose name was Phil, and he had a band called Khmer Rouge.
Yes, Phil Schofield, not that one.
Yeah,
he was obviously Marsh's ex-partner, wasn't he?
That's right. Well, the two of them were there. Yeah, he played great guitar across it. You know, that sustaining guitar and on Incense and Peppermints. I mean, we stuck to the original, really. And
yeah. But it's similar arrangement, isn't it?
But I'm quite proud of it. It's quite a good sound, you know, for considering we just bashed it out literally, you know, one afternoon, and then we had dinner.
It really doesn't sound like it's bashed out. It sounds like they've spent weeks on it.
Yeah, well, we didn't. We didn't. It was literally bashed out in a few afternoons, and then after dinner we'd go back and do Cruiser's Creek or something, you know.
I tell you what, there's no way we'd have been there to get away with that without being funny. Was there doing your solo? There was never anyone asking you to do your solo album in the mornings, was there, Steve? When you were.
One rule for one.
Go for a pint with Mark Riley, you're in the sin bin for the week.
And they did Rebellious Jukebox as well, didn't they?
That's
Searching
it.
Searching for
the B-sides and. Yeah, that's right.
Well,
but that's Carl singing at the start of Incense and Peppermints. You know, where it comes in on the intro.
Hey, there's a Sonny and Cher for the 18, isn't there? Bricks and Carl.
That's great. Sonny and Cher.
You should have marketed that, shouldn't they?
They should have done Bricks. I Got You, Babe, with Carl and Bricks.
Oh, see, if I could have suggested that, they'd have been massive. We did massive. So then the next one, and this is a bit, I don't know if it really is a sore point, is Ben Sinister.
Yeah.
I was on that briefly. I was on, we did some at Square One in Bury.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so I came back because Carl had gone by then.
I didn't quite know.
And it was before they got Simon, so I did like 3 days or something. And we did Dr. Faustus. Living Too Late.
Hot After Shave Pop.
Did A. Luciani.
Did we not?
Or Not After Shave Pop, yeah. Yeah. So then where was the rest of it done?
I don't know, actually. I'm looking at it. I thought that was done in
Abbey Road, was it?
Well, Abbey Road, yeah. Mr. Pharmacists and British Grenadiers and Bournemouth Runner. Maybe Riddler as well, but Bournemouth Runner, British Grenadiers, and Mr. Pharmacist were definitely done at Abbey Road. And there's no multi-track. I don't know if anyone, I kept telling people, and no one really understood it, because I had this thing that we were doing all these tracks.
Yeah.
Simon was putting stuff down. Mark was basically...
Which Simon? Which Simon are you talking? We've got two Simons then, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I mean Simon Rogers, is it? Yeah. Simon Rogers. With his keyboards and different ideas and things, would put stuff down. Some were good, some were, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And then invariably Mark would 1 minute say he likes it and then he doesn't, and then it would be taking it all off and this kind of thing. I don't know. I got to this stage where I thought, hang on, all Mark really wants to hear is what he hears on the first playback. So when you play as a band and you record it and you listen back, and like I or the producer says, yeah, that's a good take, listen back to it. Mark listens back, and to him that's a record finished.
Yeah.
You know, there's no reason to mix it or tamper with it, kind of thing.
Yes.
And of course what I end up doing, or what you normally end up doing, is pulling it apart and adding things, overdubbing, mixing it, making the bass a bit bassier and the snare drum with a bit of reverb, you know, those sort of things, whatever. And Mark didn't want all that. So I said, well, I'll tell you what we'll do, we're going to Abbey Road, and I think we were there 2 days or even only 1 day. just record straight stereo, straight down to. It's actually recorded on a, what's it called, an F1, which is a. There should be a tape of it. So I did it on tape and the digital video cassette as well, which was only better at the time. Sony Betamax was, no, not Betamax. What's the other one?
I can't. No, it was the 2000, was it? Cinema 2000 or something it was.
Yeah.
Supposedly it had fantastic fidelity, so it sounded exactly, there was no hiss on it or anything.
That's right, yeah.
That was the future. I know that because the band I was in after the fall, we had a drum machine and we used one for the drums and a bloody video recorder. And then we supported the fall and I think Simon tried to put it on fast forward after.
So what I'm saying is that there's no multi-track of Mr. Pharmacist. So if someone wanted to find, you know, the 24-track of Mr. Pharmacist, it doesn't exist. You know, you can't.
Really? Right. So it was just two-track then? That was, well, I'm obviously not recorded.
Yeah.
Right. So.
Yeah, two-track.
So even that wasn't rough enough for Matt. He wanted it from the cassette. Is that true? He wanted the album from the cassette?
It might, but I don't think it's for the whole album. But yes, there were incidences because the three records I did and most of the records I did at that time were mastered by a guy called Steve Angel at Utopia Studios. And what was great about his mastering room is he had big speakers and he was a very smart guy. You know, always had a tie and looked really clean and everything. But he had a fish tank with these tropical fish in between the speakers. So you could stand there and just watch all these, you know, big tropical fish tanks.
He must have been deaf as a bleeding post, that fish.
But he mastered all those records and he was really great and did loads of stuff. And we made up the side, cut it and everything, because it was really disc cutting. It wasn't mastering. You had to cut an LP on vinyl, you have to play that side from start to finish, you know, and then that's it. Then it's sent off to the factory kind of thing. So Mark would sit there while we did that and then at the end object to it all. And it's like, Mark, you know, and he's saying, well, I think you've changed the mixes around and accused me of not using the same mixes. And the running order was different. And I'm like, no, the running order is the same. Look, on the cassette as what we've got it here on the master, you know. And he was just kind of, you know what Mark was like, you know, he was questioning everything that I was doing. And he played the cassette of, I can't remember, there might have been one or two songs, I'm not quite certain, and said it sounded better than the actual tape that we were using to cut the record. And so I just said, oh, okay, just copy the cassette. So Steve Angel copied the cassette and edited it into our tape because all the master was Polar Side One, and then he copied and edited it in, and that was used, you know. So
it's interesting, isn't it? Because you would think it'd stick out like a sore thumb. If you can't remember which tracks they were, you'd think you'd listen to them and go, bloody hell, listen to that. That's on a cassette, that.
That's the magic of the fall, you see.
Any other band would stick a mile.
It's a little bit of magic, you know, how it works. I don't know.
So you weren't there for that, Steve, no?
What's that?
You weren't there for that session there, the cut?
No, that would be like Monday morning, 10 o'clock, just me, Mark and Brits.
Right, okay. So that was the last thing you did with the fall, was it?
It was, yeah. And I'll tell you what was really odd, because, as I say, we did all these studios, you know, which I'd never worked in cheap. They were cheap. They weren't first division studios. And although we went to Abbey Road just for a day, I think, and recorded those three songs. As soon as I left, someone else was producing them. I think it was Craig Leon. And they were at Abbey Road and the whole band were recording. And Brits was doing an Adult Net solo album with a budget at Abbey Road, you know.
So Craig Leon did the Friends experiment, John, is that right?
Yeah.
And what was on that then? So that was done at a really posh studio. Oh, that was done at Abbey Road, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Partly, and partly a studio in Manchester.
Which one? The font of all knowledge.
Because that's when we did Ghost in My House, wasn't it?
It could be.
Asking me? None of us were there.
Yeah.
You're the only one who was there.
I did a lot.
So what? There, what's it like Abbey Road? Then you've both been in Abbey Road. You both recorded in Abbey Road.
Great. Great to recording, yeah. My memory is that we were in a lot longer than a day with you, John.
I think we might have been 2 or 3 days, actually.
It was a great...
Not a lot longer.
No.
It wasn't a lot longer.
It was that really big room, wasn't it? And it was all... I seem to remember us having all... It all being sort of glass-walled off.
Yeah, there's screens and stuff. You know, although the room looks great and everything, you can't... you still have to screen stuff off, you know, and you can't really have drums and acoustic guitar, for instance, you know, unless the acoustic guitar or the drums have got a roof on, you know, you end up, you know, building a box and putting a roof on or something just to keep then it all down. So it defeats the object of having the big space anyway, you know.
Yeah, of course.
But, you know, I mean, so many great records. It is like, what could you say, an acoustic amplifier, that studio, you know.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like it doesn't matter where you put the microphone, it's always going to sound good, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of studios, dead studios, you know, you have to get mics in close or you have to be precise where you're putting them. But Abbey Road 2, it doesn't matter where you put the mic, it'll always sound good. it'll always have something, you know.
So when you stopped working with the Four, was that because of that? Had you had enough or was it just that you had enough or did Mark had enough for you or...?
Probably, Mark. I had enough of me. I think we just exhausted ourselves after three albums, really. I mean, we'd kind of said all we needed to add to say to each other. I mean, Mark and Brits came round to my house for dinner a few times when we, you know, first met, kind of thing. Uh-huh. And if they were in London, we'd often hang out. You know, I was up in, you know, and up in Prestwich and stuff.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, we were... Dare I say it, we were kind of mates. I mean, to do those three records, we must have got on really well together.
I didn't think for a minute, but it's kind of when they tell the story, it's like you threw your toys out of the pram because he'd mixed from a cassette. But I don't think that's quite the case, is it?
No, it's not the case at all. You know, I love it. I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't mix a whole record on a cassette just to go for that sound, you know. But at the same time, I don't think we could have done another record together, you know.
No. Uh-huh.
Because we'd kind of exhausted our potential, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a few things like that with Mark where you look at it and everybody thinks that's a terrible idea. But then, you know, with hindsight and later on, it kind of works, doesn't it, I think?
Yeah.
He kind of knew what he was doing, I think.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I think we're about hours up, John. Lovely to talk to you.
Yeah, really nice. Yeah.
All right.
So can we do another? We can do another one where we don't bother talking about the Fall. We'll just talk about all the stuff you did before and after the Fall. I could listen to you talk about that all night. Really,
it's funny because I've been doing a few of these interview podcasts, and some of them I did one that. Do you know how long we were talking? 5 hours,
Jesus,
non-stop. We just went on and on through all sorts of stuff. Don't worry, we can edit it. And of course, he hasn't put it out yet.
Taking it. Yeah, we like to keep it lean and keep people keen, John. That's what it is.
No, it's great. It's great. I enjoyed it. Yeah, good to
see you. All right, it was great to speak to you, mate.
All right.
Take care. And as we say at the end of every one of these, we'll have to get together for a pint one of these days.
Oh, yeah.
There's going to be 500 of us in this pub, but I don't care. It's not my round. All right, John, take care.
Okay, cheers.
Thanks, John.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us again on All Brother. Episodes are now released every second Friday, so you can watch the next episode in 2 weeks. Please follow us on Twitter at All Brother Show, where you can find a link to Spotify and subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher, RSS or any other platform you care to mention. If you fancy giving us a rating on iTunes or tell your friends about us, we'll be more than grateful. If you require further reading, you can check out our books, published by Root Publishers. Hope to see you all soon, and remember, if you're driving, take your car. Ta-da!
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
ACAST powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.